Welcome, everyone, to the next episode of Mind the Meds, the neurology pharmacy focused podcast from Pharmacy Times. I am again Erica Marini, your host. I'm excited to be with you for another episode. It is early August 2026 when this episode is coming out. And it's kind of funny because I feel like all of my big like summer things this year have been early in the month. So I'm like reflecting on them as I do each of these episodes. This month, we actually just got back from a visit back east to where I grew up and where most of my family still lives. So that's always fun. But this was a special visit this time because we were there for a 90th birthday party for my grandma, which is, I mean, it's such an amazing milestone that a lot of us guests and cousins, you know, and had, you know, even a hard time wrapping our heads around in our young lives. And my grandma had 7 kids and was known as the neighborhood mom back in kind of the heyday of like the early 70s kind of era. So a lot of people were there, a lot of fun stories shared. And she loved it, but was also ready to just go home and rest because it was hot and muggy that day and also start packing for her cruise. I still have never even been on one, but grandma loves a cruise. So that's what we were up to. I hope everyone else has had a nice summer and finishes August strong. You know, I do feel like clinic slows down a little bit in the summer. We have a lot of doctors that from with families in Europe, and they take kind of extended European holidays during the summer, which is amazing. And so glad that they're able to do that. And it makes it a little bit slower in clinic, but the news does not stop. It does not slow down. So let's get into a little bit of a July roundup before our special topic for today's episode. In some FDA approval news, we talked about the delay in approval for Leqembi iClick for initiation in an earlier episode, but they did get approval early in July for that, for the initiation doses. Previously, as a reminder, this could only be done in an IV center for a long 18-month initiation period. So this is tentatively good news for patient and caregiver convenience. But it does bring about a lot of logistical challenges about who's in charge of, you know, making sure patients follow monitoring schedules and making sure they aren't dispensed medication when they haven't gotten an MRI that's required or that hasn't been reviewed or something like that. So, you know, very, again, good for convenience, but have to overcome some logistical challenges probably before we at least are using it commonplace here in our practice. Also in the dementia space, remiflansirin received fast-track designation for treatment of Alzheimer's disease, hallucinations, and delusions associated with AD psychosis. We have a couple of drugs approved for agitation in Alzheimer's, but AD psychosis currently relies on off-label treatments. Remiflansirin, as far as mechanism, is a highly selective 5-HT2A receptor inverse agonist. Its mechanism is really similar to pimavanserin, a drug that's already FDA approved for treatment of hallucinations and delusions related to Parkinson's disease psychosis. So you may see a little bit of a similarity there in potential FDA approved diagnoses there. Now, I do have experience with pimavanserin. I see a lot of movement disorders in my practice. We do not use it as first line for PD psychosis right now. So I am going to be following this drug, you know, reviewing the data as more comes out for remiflansirin to see where it might fit into practice. We also had a big approval with the first oral PCSK9 inhibitor and enlicitide. Brand name will be Lipfendra. Now, there are already, this space already, you know, exists. It's not a novel mechanism. We have injectable PCSK9 inhibitors, and they're used commonly in appropriate patients to lower cholesterol. They're very effective, but having a daily oral formulation definitely adds something to our treatment options and could be really a preferred option for patients. In studies, it lowered LDL by roughly 55 to 60% versus placebo, which does put it right in the same range as the injectables that are already available. What's missing right now for the oral formulation is cardiovascular outcomes. Cardiovascular outcomes data is pending, but it's not yet available. So that's something important to recognize when thinking about PCSK9s for your patients. In other news, I was excited to see top-line data from the BEOND, spelled B-E-O-N-D, so no Y in that BEOND, phase 3 clinical program, which is taking a look at abobotulinum toxin, or brand name Dysport, for prevention of both chronic and episodic migraine. Now, you may be thinking, yeah, we already have Botox, so we already have onobotulinum toxin for chronic migraine, but up until now, we have not had strong data for the episodic migraine population. Our onobotulinum toxin is only for chronic migraine patients. Now, we don't have full results, which, according to the sponsor, are going to be presented at an upcoming conference. So we'll need to take a look at the data closely with regard to clinical impact and placebo effect, as that's been kind of a problem with botulinum toxin trials in the past, high placebo effect rates. But, you know, this could be exciting for refractory episodic migraineurs to have a botulinum toxin option if these results do come to fruition and we can get an FDA approval for that indication. In JAMA Neurology, we had the full phase 3 PREVAIL study that looked at gefurulimab for generalized myasthenia gravis. This is a complement inhibitor, so its mechanism is pretty firmly established in GMG at this point, but this would be a once-weekly subcutaneous injection. It could be more convenient for some patients than other available complement inhibitors. So we'll definitely track and let you guys know if and when that receives FDA approval. We had more data to support tenecteplase over alteplase in acute ischemic stroke. There was a large registry-based cohort study of 133,228 patients across 2,092 clinics, U.S. clinics, published in July. The adjusted mean difference in door-to-needle time was significantly shorter in tenecteplase patients by an adjusted mean difference of 3.13 minutes, which in stroke time can be very important for outcomes. So excited to see that our institution has moved over to tenecteplase as a preferred option. But for any locations that haven't, this could be more data to support that. And finally, we had full phase 3 trial results from the TEMPO 2 study of tavapadon for Parkinson's disease. This phase 3 trial design had a flexible dose regimen for the tavapadon versus previously using fixed dose regimen trials. Tavapadon, as far as mechanism, is a selective dopamine agonist for D1 and D5. You know, dopamine agonists have been around for a long time in Parkinson's disease, right? But historical dopamine agonists target the D2 and D3 receptors and have a lot of side effects like nausea, hallucinations, somnolence, and impulse control disorders, which can be severe. I can actually think just off the top of my head of a few instances of impulse control disorders having significant impact on patient relationships and finances just from my clinic alone. So, you know, we know that dopamine agonism has motor benefits in Parkinson's. So this is a different subset of dopamine receptors, but that data, the idea that this is efficacious in motor symptoms for Parkinson's disease isn't that surprising to me. It's not as important to me for this little summary. What I did want to see and what we did see in here was only a 1% incidence of impulse control disorders, which is what they were kind of thinking. If you are selective for these other dopamine receptors, can we reduce some of the side effect burden? So it was still a side effect laden drug. It's still a side effect laden mechanism, I would say. Side effects were reported in 76% of treated patients versus 55% with placebo. So in my opinion, if I were to have some early opinions of this medication, we're now seeing a different era of Parkinson's treatments. We have this subcutaneous levodopa pump. We have kind of more advanced therapies available, but you know, there could be, you know, if I had to design a case scenario for this drug, it would likely be early PD, which is what they're studying it in. You know, you think you really want to use a dopamine agonist in this person, but you have a concern for impulse control disorders based on their patient history. You maybe could consider tavapadon in that case. And so we'll definitely watch this again if it's FDA approved. Okay, and that is all the news we have time for today. On to our special discussion for today's episode. Okay, everyone, very excited for our special topic today. We are going to be talking to Dr. Janelle Montgomery, who is an MS specialist. And so, yeah, our topic is going to be about updates in MS today. Janelle, can I ask you to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your practice?
Yeah. So thank you for having me. So I work with Duke Neurology Clinic. I've been there for about 10 years now. I primarily work with the MS team, but I also work with epilepsy and movement disorders. But most of my time is spent with MS patients. So it's a little bit about my practice. So I talk to patients about disease-modifying therapies, provide medication education. I also help manage medications. For example, if they're used for symptom management, I can help start those medications, prescribe those. So it's kind of something unique about North Carolina. And now more and more states are having pharmacists kind of prescribe medications. So I see patients, help them get started on medications. I'll follow up with them on how they're doing. If they have any like side effects, I'll help with medication management from that aspect as well. So I kind of have my hands on a lot of different things, but I really enjoy MS. I've been doing that for as long as I've been at Duke. So it's been a really great experience.
Yeah, very cool. I think we probably followed similar paths. I started here in the clinic in 2015.
Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So yeah, our timelines are pretty similar.
That's cool. When did you graduate pharmacy school?
Let's see. I graduated in 2014.
Okay, yeah. Cool. I graduated in 2013.
Okay. Yep.
All right. Cool. Yeah. We probably were at mid-year together or something like
right.
that.
We probably were. Yes. Yeah. But it's cool to talk to you then because you see like the timeline of all the MS medications that have been approved since then.
Oh my gosh. So, yeah, such really a crazy decade to have been in this space. Yes. We could not have predicted
no.
where we would be right now.
Correct.
MS is a big practice of mine as well. So I'm really excited to talk to you today and bounce some things off of you. We are covering just a little bit today of what was discussed at the recent CMSC conference.
Yeah.
These conferences are huge. I always give the disclaimer that I picked out things that seem really interesting and applicable to a lot of practices, but they fit in a ton in like a 3-day conference.
Yes.
So we could not do everything. A little bit of background on CMSC. It's the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers. And interestingly, I don't think I even knew this, but their annual meeting is the largest North American meeting for healthcare professionals and researchers engaged in MS. And I would say some related disorders, some other autoimmune neurology related disorders as well. So this year held in Charlotte, North Carolina. What I also really love about CMSC is how much they incorporate a ton of different disciplines into this conference.
Mm-hmm.
They really value and appreciate the role of all care team members. So presentations, presence by rehab, nutrition, physical therapy, others, and obviously pharmacy is pretty huge at this conference.
Right.
How would you describe the meeting since you were able to attend and how pharmacists are involved or how they can get involved?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I've been going to CMSC probably for the last like 8 or 9 years. So I'm one of the co-chairs of the Pharmacist Special Interest Group, along with Jackie Bainbridge, and she works out of University of Colorado. So we help to coordinate the speakers for pharmacists who are interested in speaking at CMSC. So yes, you are correct. Like, I love it because it is so interdisciplinary there. You just meet people who are just, just doing different things with MS. And just every time I go, I get like re-inspired to kind of implement things in my own clinic. So it's just a really great conference for anybody from physicians to, like you mentioned, social work, PT, OT, like any discipline could learn something at CMSC. So well, how pharmacists have evolved. In the beginning, when I first started coming, there were definitely less pharmacists who came, but just over the years, like every year, there's more and more pharmacists to attend. And these are, I think most are clinical pharmacists, kind of doing what we are doing it in a clinic setting. And then also there's like MSLs there as well. So it's just a really big group that continues to grow. So what we have tried to do over the past few years is make sure that pharmacists have sessions where we can present, just because we know like we have a wealth of knowledge that we can share with people who attend CMSC. And so this year, the session that I moderated was involving a discussion of supplements in MS. So that was really interesting. Ours was a little more multidisciplinary because we had also had a APP attend and present. She talked about biomarkers in MS and how you use that to make treatment decisions. So that was really interesting as well. And we had another pharmacist who presented on prescribing in older adults. So definitely like pharmacist focused topics that can be relevant for everyone. It's kind of what we target. So every year we always take suggestions from people as to like what they'd like to talk about for next year, hot topics, that kind of thing. And then we make sure that pharmacists are part of the faculty at the conference. So I think it's been going well for the past few years having pharmacists as a kind of key presenter for the conference.
Yeah, I love that. I love how it's just kind of almost advocacy for the profession as well, in a way that's super patient focused and educating, but also making sure that people realize how important we are to the MS patient, especially like we said, as meds have exploded. It's
Exactly.
really
Yes.
important.
Absolutely.
Now, Charlotte is pretty close to Duke as well. Were you guys able to have like a really large presence at the conference this year?
We had quite a few of our past fellows who are now in practice went to the conference. Our current fellow attended the conference as well. We have Dr. Shaw is one of our neuroimmunologists who kind of specializes in family planning, pregnancy, breastfeeding, and DMTs, that kind of thing. So she presented several times. We had a pretty good group. We were able to go down to Charlotte. It's always nice when it's kind of closer by. But we had a good group there. We kind of went and sometimes we got together and collaborated with each other. And then other times we were kind of seeing each other at different sessions. So it was good to kind of see people I work with directly at the conference.
Yeah, that's always nice. Almost have like a dinner buddy sometimes. Nice at a big conference, like having like a like a touchstone of someone you know there is so
Yeah, then it's like a
important.
little mini reunion.
Yeah, totally. With the old fellows and stuff. That's so cool. And I'm sure it was so nice to have team members there to celebrate with you, because I want all the audience to know that Janelle received a huge honor at this year's conference, being recognized as a giant of multiple sclerosis. The Giants of Multiple Sclerosis Recognition Program is a premier neuroscience award program that celebrates pioneers, innovators, and future generations of leaders who have been selected by their peers for their remarkable achievements in multiple sclerosis. And the awards are given out at the CMSC annual meeting. I love this recognition program because, in keeping with the CMSC kind of culture, they include a pharmacist every year in these awards. So, Janelle, tell me a bit about what this means to you.
So it was a really, really great honor. It means a lot to me because I will tell you, 10 years ago when I started, I probably wouldn't have suspected I would be in this position all this time later. Because you start and there's not a lot of people around you who kind of are doing something similar. So just to see like the pharmacist community grow over the years has been awesome, and just kind of growing my own practice has been great. But what I was really like honored about with this award, is I really have tried to kind of create a community, and I kind of coordinate these quarterly meetings with a special interest group, just based on topics that the members are interested in. And then we're able to kind of talk to each other about what are our workflows, and you can just get to meet people who are in the similar space as you. So I've put a lot of effort into like creating these communities, and it was really just nice to be like acknowledged for like work I've tried to put in. So yeah, so it was great. Like, and it was inspiring just to see the other people who were recognized as well. I'm in the other disciplines. So I really appreciated it. And, you know, I'm really glad that the CMSC has this award to see what pharmacists are doing, because, you know, there's so many people doing this so much for the MS community in the pharmacy space. So yeah, so it was a great honor to get that.
And well deserved. So congratulations. Congratulations
you so much.
Again. You're doing so much, yes, for patients, but also for pharmacy. It's you know, what really struck me about what you just said is kind of how hard it is sometimes. Like, you know, sometimes you're the only, I'm not sure if you are, but I'm the only person in my clinic. Yeah. And I started there and there was no pharmacist here. Right. 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you're kind of just like on your own for a while until you can find a community,
right,
to bounce ideas off of. Yeah. And, you know, so it's so important and it's so worthwhile to do that probably on some of your off time.
Right.
to really cultivate that. It's so important. And I'm so inspired by you. So
thank you. I appreciate that.
But you were so busy at this conference. You had mentioned already that you were part of a few sessions. I want to switch gears and talk about the session that you moderated at the conference. Can you remind us again what it was about?
Yeah. So the kind of bigger picture is like off-label discussion about various topics. So the APP who presented, she talked about biomarkers and how that affects treatment decisions in her practice. And then also there was a presentation by Stephanie Iyer. She's out of Chapel Hill. And she talked about high risk patients and kind of what we do in specific situations. So she had some very specific examples of kind of high risk patients and how we would manage those patients. And then finally, we had Julie Kidd, and she talked about the supplement use in NMS, and hers was really nice because she kind of gave like resources you could use if somebody asks you about supplements, and then also went through specific supplements that are kind of like commonly asked about, and talked about like what the recommendations are based on the data that she has. So it was a really good like kind of like off-label discussion about things that come up kind of frequently in practice.
Oh my gosh. I don't know if you know this, Janelle, and I don't know actually if it's a validated statistic, but Utah, where I practice, is known as like the supplement capital of the country.
I did not
and,
know that.
Yeah. So it is, we get that a ton, and it is so important. And I'm so thankful, honestly, to be here so that I can answer those questions.
Right.
Because they come up so often, and it's, you know, people can really be, you know, emotionally drawn to certain advertisements for supplements and what they can offer without being transparent about what's inside and about what we know and don't know about these supplements.
Right.
And it's,
I feel like patients kind of assume it's safe because you can get it like over the counter.
It's herb,
you
know, it's herbal, right, it's vitamins.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's, you know, I always tell patients, like, you know, if you're starting to get to like, you know, 5, 10, 15 supplements, it may be excessive. You're making your liver work really hard.
And your wallet.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, actually a patient, I never heard of this like term before, but a patient recently sent me, she said it was called a supplement stack. And so she, you know, she works with this company and she takes like probably about like, I don't know, 15 doses of supplements per day, kind of throughout the day. So she wanted me to kind of review it and see if it interacted with her MS medications. But yeah, the supplement like stack term I'd never heard of before. That was interesting. A new endeavor for supplements, I guess.
Yeah. And hopefully will not become a trend.
Right.
Because that is a lot.
Yes. Yeah, she did say it was very expensive. You're right.
Yeah, they do. They get very expensive, and it honestly gets very hard to counsel about, because, you know, some of these newer supplements have sometimes they they name things differently from like what they actually are. And
Right,
it's
right.
hard to, it's hard to find data to be able to even reliably say like, oh, I don't, this could interact. I don't know.
Right. Yep.
I
Yep.
guess
Exactly.
we'll find out
Yes.
if you
Right.
really want to take guess.
Yes, that is right. Yes, it's always it's a mystery, but yeah, I
Yes.
encourage patients. So there's a place for some supplements, but yeah, I tell patients to like exercise caution and also tell us so we can put it on their med list so we can do a drug interaction check if we need to. So yes.
Absolutely. That is my most important counseling point is if you want to start a supplement, message me first.
Yes,
And we
exactly.
can go over at least what we do know
Right.
about it.
Yes.
So, supplements are a big thing here, but what's not a big thing here quite yet is using biomarkers in regular clinical practice. What was kind of the rundown of the APP's discussion there?
Yeah, so I thought her discussion was really interesting, just to see kind of how she uses them in practice. So, her focus was about neurofilament light chain, but she also kind of briefly talked about some like proteins she tracks as well. But I think her take home point, which really kind of resonated, is using it as like a tool, but in something that you would track over time. So maybe like if you get one lab, like one NfL, and kind of see what that is in the moment, that might not tell you a lot of information. But just seeing how patients are doing clinically, and then comparing that to what these biomarkers are coming back as, may be a useful kind of clinical tool. So yeah, especially people who aren't having, or maybe up here aren't having these like clear like relapses, they may be having progression, then that might inform them as to like what may be happening over time, kind of maybe subclinically. So yeah, so I thought it was a really interesting lecture. In our practice, there's only like one or two providers who have used it on a couple of patients, so I wouldn't say it's like mainstream with us yet, but yeah, I do think over time that we'll keep, start using it more and more, just looking at kind of where biomarkers are going at this point.
Yeah, I would say that our practice is pretty similar. And the providers that I've talked to about it probably do it in the way that the APP would not recommend, which is, oh, this patient presented to the hospital. Let's just see what the neurofilament light chain right
Right.
now, just out of like a curiosity, but not necessarily tracking them over time. But yeah, I think as we gain more knowledge about that, the progressive portion of MS and just anything that we can use to further personalize care is going to be so important as we go forward. We've got like relapsing MS pretty handled at this point. And let's yeah, I think we're trying to move to these other things, although haven't been super successful in moving the needle really on them there. But I was very, I think that of the biomarkers, neurofilament light chains, would you agree, are probably the furthest along in being able to be used in clinical practice. So
Definitely.
we'll probably see more uptake here in the maybe in the next few years.
Right. And now that more people are using it, maybe the studies, will get stronger, and kind of provide some like clear guidance on how to like implement it. So I think there's more to
Right. Like you followed them and this is what you did and this is how they changed, which is kind of what we're missing in the current data set that we have. So true. So true. So definitely biomarkers are a hot topic. A couple of other hot topics discussed at CMSC that I wanted to make sure we talk about because I think they're pretty widely applicable. Drug discontinuation in MS as well as pregnancy. So a little background on the drug discontinuation debate in MS for any listeners who might not be familiar. So, we know that the immune system kind of naturally calms as we age, but MS is still a really unpredictable disease at any age. So, given this dichotomy, we don't know when or if you can really safely stop MS medications at any time. Would you do it at a certain age or after a certain length of time with stable disease or based on certain biomarkers, maybe that we have or don't even have yet, or findings on an MRI? Or do you have to look at a combo of all of these things and use a complicated, algorithm? This is becoming really important because we have now all of these MS medications. They've gotten more complicated. They have more side effects. And patients are living to really old ages, and they're just being continued right now on these what we might call high-risk medications. Yeah. So it's certainly something that's top of mind for a lot of us. So, with that baseline context, let's, maybe start with a brief rundown of how our centers currently approach drug discontinuation, which could be a little messy because a little bit provider specific, at least at my place. Maybe how it's evolved in the time since we've practiced in our clinics. Do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So I think, the recent studies like the DISCO trial have largely informed our practice as to kind of at least pointed us in a direction. So with my practice, many of the providers, not all, but most of them will start having the discussion around the age of 60 if the patient brings up, wanting to potentially stop DMTs. I think there's a lot of discussion as to whether you wait for the patient to bring it up or should the provider bring it up. But if a patient brings it up, at least then they'll look at usually around the age of 60, and they'll look back about 10 years and see how stable they've been. And if they've been clinically and radiographically stable, then they would support coming off of it, off of DMTs, and then, kind of reevaluating and, check MRIs from there. So it's kind of interesting because, the people who I get the most questions about this from are the people who are in their 20s and they're asked during the visit, when can I stop this medication? So I think it's an important topic because, you want to, give them hope and maybe not say indefinitely you will be on this medication.
Right.
So I do give them the time point of maybe around 60, we talk about their immune
retirement
system. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So I think we're having the discussion more often because now we have some guidance from studies. But I would say most of our providers are pretty comfortable around the age, 60, 65, and then looking back about 10 years to see how they've been doing. How is your practice approaching that?
We are pretty similar. Yeah, I think the trial that you talked about, I think they started that an intervention as early as 55, we also do not have that discussion at 55.
Right.
Anyway, I would say closer to 65 is when that discussion first comes up. And for most providers, it's kind of a very cautious, just testing the waters. We mentioned it. We'll continue to mention it. And that kind of starts at 65. And then from there, it's just kind of, we just kind of let the patient kind of ride the wave at that point. It seems like a lot of weird, your three times a week injection, you want to taper down to once a week.
Right.
Sure. If that vibe feels good for you, let's do that for 6 months and then stop. We've even considered in patients who don't feel comfortable stopping, switching them from a high efficacy medication that maybe carries more immunosuppressive risk to downgrading to a moderate or low efficacy medication to kind of mitigate that risk in someone who's stable. But yeah, I would agree. Factors are always age, as well as looking back at stability of disease, number of relapses in the past 10 years, radiographic as well as clinical, and then symptom progression as well. So seems like practices are a little bit similar. Like we said, we don't know about we don't know the final answer here. I'm interested in hearing any discussion from CMSC on this with all those great minds in the room. I think you're able to attend an update on that as well.
Yeah. So the primary investigator for the DISCO trial presented, and he kind of went over the trial and kind of what the takeaways were, which, it didn't have a very strong, clear direction to go, but it did. I think he talked about like maybe having changed, if he could go back and do it again, he might have changed some of the outcomes a little bit to make the trial a little bit stronger. But yeah, he did a review of that trial. And then you're right, the next discussion was about like, when do you kind of maybe step down therapy versus like not completely discontinuing DMTs? So yeah, so it was a good review of kind of like what considerations to take into account for older patients. And yeah, and kind of how he would revise his trial, I guess, if he could kind of go back and do it again. But one thing that kind of came up also was like, I think we got some information from the COVID when that was going on, kind of full force, and yes, like what to do with like, you know, spacing out, for example, like ocrelizumab infusions, like do they need to be every, you know, 6 months versus maybe spacing it out to like a year and or waiting to track your B cells to see if they're coming back and then redosing. So yeah, kind of extended interval dosing was a topic as well as to how to maybe approach DMTs for older patients. So that was interesting.
Yeah, I think there's a ton of strategies, and yeah, and as long as you're having that discussion with the patient about what you know and don't know,
right,
about exactly the options, I think it's definitely a new frontier. But I get excited when a patient is able to stop treatment. I'm a pharmacist and I love drugs, but
right,
you know, but it's also exciting whenever you can remove a drug from a med list. I think that's an exciting part of pharmacy as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Very cool. Still a lot to come, I think, on that topic. We'll be very personalized on that. Okay. And now pregnancy comes up a lot in MS because it's so prevalent in young women. I was really excited to see a few abstracts presented for pregnancy and breastfeeding. And there was also that great presentation given that you mentioned already, pregnancy and breastfeeding at CMSC this year. I'll go first this time. I'll just kind of discuss our kind of practice here and approach to pregnancy. And as we gather kind of more info in this space, but essentially, right now, you know, we do know in general that MS is largely kind of quiescent during pregnancy. Yeah. So it is still our general strategy in most patients to be off of, I will say, active DMT. So not getting any new doses of anything during pregnancy. A common strategy that we use in talking to young women, which are also very prevalent in Utah, so we have this discussion a lot, is the idea of maybe getting them on something that we have really reassuring data in pregnancy on, like Ocrevus. Right. You start it, and then this is kind of where it differs provider to provider, honestly, is right, you can get someone initiated on Ocrevus. We generally, honestly, like to get the two induction doses and then the first 6 month dose in before someone starts trying to conceive. Where the providers differ is when they will recommend starting to try to conceive after an Ocrevus dose. I generally will tell people just to wait a couple weeks. Some providers, though, like to wait like even up to a few months after the Ocrevus. That's kind of a difference in practice, which we're still waiting on, I think, finite data, which we may never get on that. But and then you try to conceive for, as much as you can. If you get into that kind of like that last month before you would be due for a next dose, use contraception, get your dose of Ocrevus and kind of start that all over again. That is our most common pregnancy scenario at this point. If someone's on other medications, we simply have them stop it when they're trying to conceive. We do have a few patients who have stayed on glatiramir. Really highly active patients may get a dose of Ocrevus, may get Tysabri during pregnancy. Those are more one-offs. The Ocrevus strategy is kind of our most common at this point. Yeah. We'd love to hear what you guys are doing.
Yep. That's very similar to us. So we do quite a bit of Ocrevus while someone is family planning. We have, and other DMTs, like oral DMTs, we have them stop that medication and switch usually to an anti-CD20. And we've been doing a little more Briumvi, but mostly Ocrevus, because we have maybe the most data on that. We have like maybe one or two people on Kesimpta, which I know we're going to talk about a little bit more. But most have gotten Ocrevus, and then our providers usually do. Not trying for about 2 to 3 months after the Ocrevus infusion, and then trying and then kind of going in that pattern. So I think our approaches are pretty similar.
Yeah, I love to hear that. Sometimes I
Yeah.
listen to what I'm doing in other people. I like
Right.
So love to hear that. We must be at the top of our games, everyone
Yes, absolutely. And when we do have some Tysabri patients, if someone happens to have been on Tysabri, they can continue like for one or two doses until their pregnancy. If someone is really highly active, and has highly active MS, we'll go as far as 30 weeks. But most people, they'll stop at around like 20 weeks or so. But most people are on Ocrevus.
And like we said, no Ocrevus doses during pregnancy, but we did have data presented at CMSC. And maybe we can kind of go back and forth on these abstracts because we have three abstracts here. So, first, like Janelle mentioned, we now have 10 years and 5,000 pregnancies worth of data with ocrelizumab. Ocrevus. I've been bad at using brand names in this podcast. Ocrelizumab. I, of course, really liked this one because, like we both said, ocrelizumab has been something that we have offered as part of family planning discussions in the past few years, because we felt really reassured by the data. So this abstract was data reported to the Roche database, so it could even be underrepresented if patients didn't report. So they looked at Ocrevus exposure during pregnancy or less than or equal to 3 months before the last menstrual period as kind of exposure time period. Results showed continued reassuring outcomes, no increased risk of adverse pregnancy or infant outcomes. So, adding to that reassuring data, it's just a really strong amount of patients. It's kind of like buzzwords, like 10 years, 5,000 pregnancy. And so I think that reaching that threshold is really going to resonate with hesitant patients. And so that's what I really took away from this abstract and really liked about it. So next we had, and I think you already mentioned you guys have a couple patients on ofatumumab during family planning discussions, or Kesimpta as its known brand name. We had an abstract on that was presented.
Ofatumumab is a little bit more challenging because the dosing is every 28 days. So we can't do the timing like we do for the infusions that are like every 6 months or every 24 weeks. So there was a study kind of looking at patients who were pregnant, and they looked back 180 days prior to pregnancy, and also looked at patients who were on the ofatumumab during pregnancy, and they looked at those infant outcomes. So this was from a Novartis database. And what they were looking for were they were looking at pregnancy terminations, they're looking at stillbirths, ectopic pregnancies, and also looking at malformations. So any like major or minor malformations were kind of included for things that they looked for. And what they took away from this study was that the prevalence of the major and minor malformations was similar to the general population. So there wasn't an increase with ofatumumab, which is very reassuring. I think prior to this, we didn't have a lot of information about ofatumumab. We kind of extrapolated from our other anti-CD20 DMTs, but studies like this really help to like kind of share with patients saying like they have looked at this for ofatumumab and have not found any increase compared to other people who are not on DMTs or who don't have MS. So I think that was really reassuring information as well.
Yeah, there's something about obviously we have to extrapolate so much data in so many scenarios, and there's something about extrapolating it during pregnancy that makes you just a little bit more nervous, right? You really want the data. Like, I really want the data with that specific drug. I don't want to extrapolate when someone's pregnant and someone's like fetal development is on the line. So I love it. I love that the drug companies are also committed to this data for sure. They obviously have their own reasons for doing it as well, but it's really important that they're tracking that and releasing the data as it comes out. So yes, very reassuring. And then on the other side, once baby's out, we haven't talked about breastfeeding yet, but that's obviously really important as well, across the childbirth spectrum. So our last abstract on this topic took a look at ublituximab, known as Briumvi, transfer into breast milk. They only had, this is going to be a small study of, I think, 16 patients, they said. They only had one patient to report results on so far, but showed what is considered to be a very low relative infant dose transferred into the breast milk and completely undetectable in milk by day 28. So this is mostly data that we again kind of extrapolated based on other anti-CD20s sharing the same mechanism. But like I said, it always lends more strength to the counseling session when you have actual data with the drug in question. And anti-CD20s, I think, are as far as breastfeeding, like they're a little bit easier, honestly. They're really large molecules. They're not going to get into breast milk. They're going to be broken down by the baby's GI tract. But you know, there is real counseling that comes in. I feel like sometimes people forget about like the pre-medications, which can have implications for breastfeeding. Yeah, would you agree, Janelle, with that summary? Anything you'd want to add about this abstract or?
One thing that I really liked that they included was also like the adverse effect profile. Because I think, of course, moms are concerned about that for their babies. So just, seeing that from the study that the adverse effect profile wasn't like significant. And also they, said that, the illnesses that the children, I guess, in the trial had were nothing more than like maybe like daycare illnesses that you would expect or childhood illnesses. So nothing like significant that was going on there. So I think that's also helpful information to share that might reassure a mother or parents. So I know I think this data is really helpful again for kind of reassurance and I'm glad that they're kind of tracking this outcomes, especially with breastfeeding. But in our practice, let's say someone were to resume an anti-CD20, especially infusions, where they to get pre-medications, we hold Benadryl in particular, just because it can decrease breast milk production. We also don't want to make the baby drowsy, so we'll change that to a non-sedating antihistamine. But that's the biggest change we make with pre-medications, is addressing the Benadryl component of that.
Yes, absolutely. We generally do the same thing. I always counsel, you know, if you have a reaction, you're going to get Benadryl. I can't do anything about it. I counsel about that as well. But we do try to just stick to a non-drowsy as well for that same reason, especially because we are, you know, we do try to resume DMT so quickly after pregnancy, and you're really at that point still establishing breastfeeding as well. And so, really important to not hinder that as wherever we can possible.
We get a lot of questions about like, do I have to pump and dump? Which I know is not always like the most convenient thing or something you want to do. So we, tell patients, no, you don't have to go and do that with these medications. So I think it's good to have those counseling points ready.
Yeah, and especially it's nice with to have the stat on ublituximab now because it's like such a shorter infusion time, which I feel like is really nice for a new mom. I kind of hated when, you know, when someone's on Ocrevus is such a great drug, but you know, it's like you're 2 weeks after birth of a child, and you like it'll be about 6 hours.
Yes, right. Exactly. Exactly.
So it's good. It's good that we're having data on all of these newer medications. So that's awesome. Okay. Wow. I think we could go for much longer, but I do advertise this podcast as an easily digestible length, and so we may have time for just one more topic. And I feel like honestly, I have to talk about GLP-1s no matter what our special topic of the day is because they're so prevalent in everything right now. So we're getting more and more questions about GLP-1s in MS. Is your clinic the same?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I feel like many patients are on them now. And so we do get a lot of questions lately.
Yeah, so many patients are on them. A couple patients have asked if we will prescribe them. Currently, that is not something that we are doing. just because I would say, and we'll talk about this a little bit, but the data for use in MS is just not super strong right now. So we are staying out of the prescribing GLP-1 game as long as we can, or until we have data that suggests that it's useful for the primary diagnosis that we see them for.
Right.
I was glad to see that CMSC is on the pulse of, it seems like, everything. They did have an invited lecture about this topic specifically, and I really liked how they approached it as well, from kind of like two sides, from the lens of patients using this under an approved indication of, you know, weight loss or diabetes who also have MS, and the benefits and safety from that perspective. And then also the early research that is available for potential use as an adjunctive treatment for MS. Yes. So what is kind of your GLP spiel, if you will, when you get a question from a patient or provider about GLP-1s in this space?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I've had patients like ask me just if there's drug interactions with their other either DMTs or other medications they're taking. I mean, DMT wise, from what we've seen so far, there's no major interactions. It's safe to, you know, go ahead and take those medications. I also get questions from patients about, you know, will this help my MS? So I agree that the study they went over at CMSC, kind of looking at patients who are on ocrelizumab specifically, and they also are either already on a GLP-1 or are going to start a GLP-1, will provide some helpful information. But I just generally tell patients, like, GLP-1s have been looked at various neurodegenerative disorders. I think it looks, there's promising information about it. Like, maybe there is something about like an anti-inflammatory effect or an antioxidant effect that may be helpful, but we just don't have the data yet to strongly recommend this medication class, specifically for MS. But one thing that was helpful about the study and background that was presented at CMSC was, you know, people who are obese may have, you know, more progression and maybe more disability and that kind of thing. So there are other ways that you can help your MS kind of indirectly that I think it would be good for, you know, if patients wanted to try GLP-1s and it was indicated for them. So, so it's usually what I share with patients and providers about the class.
Yeah, I think I generally focus on, you know, not necessarily the treatment of MS, but how it's not known to worsen MS, not known to interact with your meds, like you said, and, you know, weight loss could have benefits to your MS. So it's certainly worth a try. So I think very similar in practice there as well.
Yeah.
Okay. This has been such a wonderful discussion.
Yeah.
I do. I always like to end the podcast with a little work-life balance. It is summer season. This is also kind of travel inspo for myself. This is what it's kind of become. It's been awesome.
Yeah.
So where is somewhere near or far that you have visited recently?
Yeah, good question. So I have a 3-year-old, so we're trying to make her a world traveler. So when she was 1.5, he took her to Paris, which was great. Paris, very family oriented. Like, it was great. So that was fun. And then last December, we went to Aruba with her. So she loved the beach. It was actually her first time at a beach. So she got to do it in Aruba. So we are just, you know, trying to get our travels in. We're hoping next year we might target Italy, but I'm definitely going to keep traveling with her to, you know, see the sights. But it's fun to, you know, take a toddler and, see what there is out there. And a lot of, you know, other countries are really just family oriented and love the children. So it's helpful.
Yeah. That's amazing, Janelle. I feel like we are the same person. I also have a 3-year-old.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes, I do. And a 1.5-year-old. So we are not going to Google Cares. Maybe if I had just one, but not with the two. I talk about that way too much on this podcast. how scared I am to travel. But yes, I'm also, my gosh, again, same. I'm trying to get a trip planned to Italy in the summer of 2028. My dad was born in Italy.
Oh, really?
Has never taken us to Italy.
Oh, wow. And
even now I said, hey, I want to go. I want our whole family to go to Italy. You can be tour guide. And he just kind of like scoffed at me. But luckily, I have like a whole year to
Yes.
kind of
Yes.
needle him a little bit, getting on
Right.
board, get
Yeah.
my Duolingo on
Right,
for
exactly.
Italian, and
Yes.
we'll have to talk more about our planning.
Definitely, definitely. We just need some toys for
Yes.
the flight. And
Maybe,
that'll be it.
yes, that's all we need. Toys and snacks
Yes.
for the
Yes.
flight,
Good
for
to
us and for the
know.
kids, and for my dad to get him on the flight. It'll
Right.
be great. Maybe you can plan a CMSC event there and I will be there.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Okay,
Good idea.
well, I will let you go. Enjoy the rest of your summer. Thank you again for coming on
Yeah,
this
no
podcast. This
problem.
has been
Thanks for
such a
having me.
fun time. And yeah, thank you everyone for listening and tune in next month.